Hi everyone, and thank you very much for joining us on another episode of Lit, a Publishing's podcast, Lit Radio. My name is Miro, and I will be your host for today's show. With me today is a very special author. It is Sean Pillott de Chennessy. How are you today, Sean?
I'm fine, thank you. And yourself?
I'm very well, thank you very much for asking. And Sean is the author of The Post-Truth Business. He is also a marketing expert who has over 20 years of brand consultancy with all sorts of different companies out there. His clients include Unilever, Swatch, Heineken, etc. And we are very happy to have him here talk about his new book, The Post-Truth Business. But before we get into the meat of the conversation, Sean, I really want to ask you, what inspired you to become an author and start writing?
Well, I've been writing for many years, so I've written for, within reason, just about every sort of trend magazine there is out there in various parts of the world. But this is my first book, and what really drove me to it was just the sort of frustration that no one else had written something like it first. And bizarrely, to me particularly, it still appears to be the first book that has joined the dots between all those things that so many people talk about, as in, post-truth, fake news, privacy, mm-hmm. transparency, ethics, but from a business point of view. So there are plenty of books out there looking at, the sort of social and cultural context through a sort of a political prism from the point of view of, where we are now. But this, luckily for me, appears to be the first one to look at it from a business point of view. So, I wrote it because no one else had.
Great. And the title itself, The Post-Truth Business. Now, that's something that really stuck out for me. And I think a title is at the core of any book. And can you perhaps, let's elaborate a bit on it. What was the methodology and the idea behind the very title of the book? And although you've already touched upon it, what is post-truth business? What does that mean?
Okay, well, I mean, I think we could all, I'm sure, agree that we are living in interesting times, should we say, as the Chinese would put it, having grown up over there. This issue of, we're in a situation whereby all businesses want to have strong and long-lasting relationships with their consumers, to state the stunningly obvious. But, every relationship, be it, between politician and voter, or brand and consumer, or between employer and employee, or indeed within ourselves in our own personal relationships, all relationships are built on trust. But this issue we find ourselves in now, whereby truth and trust are up for grabs, whereby we're told that truth is subjective, and that experts are the enemy, is a real concern. When we're finding ourselves in a situation whereby, so much of modern life is really defined by mistrust, that's a huge issue for society in general, a real issue for us as individuals and consumers, and a huge issue for brands and organizations of all types.
Yeah, absolutely. And the very thought of a subjective truth is actually a rather frightening thought. And the very fact that we are, talking about what is truth, can it really be objective or is it always subjective, is, I think, a rather fascinating issue in itself. But let's talk a bit about the business side of it all, as you mentioned. So if you're a business, if you're a brand and you're faced with all of this, what are the most important issues facing you? How do you address them? And especially if you're going out there on a global scale, I'm pretty sure there's a lot more to consider than just being in the domestic market.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, it obviously impacts brands around the world, and different countries, different societies, different cultures naturally have their own take on this, to state the stunningly obvious. But in terms of having a lowest common denominator, whereby brands and organizations of all types need to think about how they behave, and to me, behavior really is at the basis of all of this. We judge businesses by their behavior. Their credibility is based on experience. The experience that you or I have from any brand in a business context, be it a hotel or a hire car company or a food brand or a fashion brand or whatever, it's all down really to to experience that we have ourselves. You know, that's how we're sort of, you know, basing our viewpoints of the brand in question. I think the issue we're seeing more and more is that, I mean, I spent many years in advertising, and any advertising agency anywhere in the world would tell you that, you know, feelings beat facts. But what we're seeing increasingly is that, you know, more and more people want the truth. And so, you know, in the book, I finish the book, if you like, on a post-truth manifesto. I mean, all publishers love manifestos because they're great to for right, journalists yeah. to report on.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I talk about those issues about, you know, so, you know, authenticity is something that, you know, has been spoken about since brands first began. And so I talk about, you know, brands have to live it like they say it. You know, the whole thing about, you know, obsessing over heritage and origins, you know, brands having to revel in their individuality and distinctiveness. You know, more and more people we're seeing are viewing themselves as being like so-called informed consumers, you know, making, you know, intentional buying choices. So not just buying without any thought, but, you know, really considering the implications of their consumption. I mean, naturally, a lot of people still buy purely on the basis of price, you know, and lowest possible price due to the realities of, you know, still 10 years on from the downturn, how that is so heavily impacted the vast majority of society. But also, next to that, say, when we're in a situation whereby in just about every sector, we have multiple choices, to put it mildly, you know, every price point, most brands are incredibly similar to each other. So, the real difference now, I think, between brands in virtually every sector is really increasingly between effectively good brand versus bad brand. You know, the brands we trust versus the ones we don't. And so what I talk about in the book is how, you know, when choice is available, people will choose a trusted brand. And the one area I finish this point on there is that, you know, one thing with great irony, you know, the one sector whereby this doesn't really work or this argument doesn't stack up is in the very sector that has brought us so many of these problems. So in the world, you know, so in the Silicon Valley, you know, world, you know, where those giants have such staggering power in the current era, you know, the likes of Facebook that have been exposed so correctly for the activity that they've been involved with or have been sort of usurped by, depending on which side of the story you're on. You know, when you're looking at the impacts of things like Cambridge Analytica, data scraping, how that's impacted on democracy, etc. You know, we saw, you know, earlier this year when it was exposed that, you know, via, you know, again, sort of leveraging the abilities given to them via Facebook, that, you know, Cambridge Analytica, you know, got up to 7,000 data points on every member of the US electorate, etc., and they'd impacted the presidential election of Donald Trump. They impacted on the Brexit vote. You know, we saw the delete Facebook campaign going, but really that fizzled out quite quickly, because where else do you go when there's no competition?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, if you're annoyed with VW about the emissions scandal or whatever, you've got plenty of choices, as you are if you're annoyed with a bank due to their activity in the downturn, or if you're annoyed with fashion companies about having products made in third world sweatshops. But in the social media world, there isn't, or there aren't, you know, 10 versions of Facebook, effectively. You know, so it's very interesting how that one sector has it really sewn up. Therefore, only governmental activity can really impact on them.
Yeah, agreed on that point. And it leads very well into sort of my next point of conversation here, Sean. And that's this technological leap. And you mentioned there, and that's a very sound point, that, you know, effectively, there is no competition in some of these sectors, especially technology, simply because where do you go? Well, you don't really have much choice. And with that, you have, as you say, a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of things going in the background, and there are fingers being pointed in literally every direction towards literally everyone.
Yep.
But that's more on, I guess, on a cultural, political side. But if we talk about a business, if we talk about a brand, and this idea that you mentioned about, you know, being authentic, and actually you have to clash with this at some point. How can brands stay on course and actually keep their authenticity, whatever they may be, in this age of, you know, misinformation and rapid technological consumption?
Well, as I say, my big thing is that, you know, they have to live it like they say it. I mean, the answer to all of this is not an advert. You know, it's so marketing plays has a very strong role to play, but it's very much, I'd argue, only one of the things that businesses should consider, because, you know, this is all about leadership. This is all about, you know, every facet of the organization being involved. So, and again, one of the things I talk about a lot is this issue of brands increasingly having to become more activist in nature in order to underline who they are. And so, you know, a brand that I'm no fan of, but a brand that has done a lot in this area, and indeed very recently, are Nike. So, you know, so when you're looking at their activity, obviously with the Kaepernick ad, and which obviously linked totally into the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, via the sort of, you know, Take the Knee campaign. You know, when we're seeing brands taking action on an apolitical basis, whereby they know that whatever they do, there will be, you know, the stance they take will be controversial. It will annoy a, you know, a significant element of the consumer base. But if it's right for the brand to do, and if it's relevant for the brand to do it, then I think increasingly brands are going to be doing precisely that. I mean, you could argue that Nike thought that through, and you know, reasonably enough, obviously from a, you know, from a hard-headed business level. If you looking at the Nike audience, particularly in the US, the age of them, you know, the backgrounds of those people, taking the stance they did, and obviously it's one that I'm sure we all totally agree with, was the right thing to do on a moral level and on a straightforward, you know, bottom line business level. So they annoyed some consumers, they annoyed some people, but the vast majority got behind them because they were seen to be basically standing for the very sort of issues that they should be standing for. And so the key thing to them, obviously, is they've got to keep it going. You know, that cannot just be one ad. It's got to be something that they continue to stand by, because I remember way back in the late 90s, I remember having a chat with Naomi Klein, obviously, who wrote No Logo, and I sort of, you know, wrote a piece at that point for the late great Face magazine about shock advertising, and you know, Nike got it in a big way at that point, because they obviously were exposed by their activity in terms of third world production methodologies, and given their due, they dealt with it. But you know, there's a lot of that stuff going on then. There's still a lot of it going on, and brands have to have to do the right thing, because they will get caught out. And we're in an era where, again, to use a real typical Adland phrase, you know, if nothing else, good business is good business.
And just to follow up on that, there's a lot of interesting points there. And just, I guess, not even to play devil's advocate, but in this great example that you've given us in terms of Nike, as a you know, multinational, ginormous brand out there, you know, as you mentioned, they have been known to be involved in, let's say, less than favorable business practices in the past. Do you think that a stance like what they've done recently or their recent campaign is more to do with perhaps atonement or cleaning up a brand image or reinventing themselves, or is it simply something to do with trends more like, or is it just what they feel was right? As you said, can there be any other aspects to that?
Oh, there are plenty of other aspects to it. And I think, again, I mean, the classic example of this, which again I cover in the book in detail, is what I describe, I think, with entirely sort of a reasonable point of view, as being the worst ad of all time, the ultimate ad fail, which was obviously the infamous Pepsi Kendall Jenner, you know, sort of ad, which, I mean, when I was writing the book, you know, I interviewed a ton of people about it, and it was good to watch that ad over and over again, because every time you watch it, it gets steadily worse and more and more entertaining. I mean, it's so bad, it just defies belief. And it was what I think was interesting for a lot of people in industry at that point, or a lot of people on the agency side, was, I mean, Pepsi had a fairly good track record of linking with, you know, as we used to quaintly call it, youth culture, and yet with that ad, they just, you know, obviously it was so appallingly bad on so many levels, you know, so evidently, you know, trying to leverage again the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, you can't get much more serious than that, and much more, you know, compelling of an issue to be treated with respect. And to try and monetize it was, again, mind-boggling, and to do it so badly was amazing. Obviously, in Adland, the one saving grace was that it obviously turned out fairly quickly that it wasn't made by an agency, it was actually made in-house at Pepsi.
Right,
so,
right.
So it was high fives all round in Adland when they found that out. But yeah, that's a classic example of a brand effectively doing the opposite of what I'm suggesting. You know, i.e., they're just, you know, jumping on something that's culturally or socially important and tacking, you know, the brand logo on the end of it, and very rightly being caught out as a result.
Yeah, and it kind of leads me into what I want to talk about next, Sean, and that's the brand credibility gap, which you address within the book. And what is it, first of all, and how do brands narrow it? I mean, what we talked about surely feeds into that.
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, you know, again, this issue has been looked at by, obviously, everyone out there. I mean, have us, you know, great agency, they did a lot of global work on this, and so, you know, they talk about, you know, the fact that, you know, a lot of the trust and respect and loyalty that people have had for brands has disintegrated. You know, they talk about, you know, you just look at the amount of cynicism, skepticism and indifference that people have, and it really, really, you know, sums that up. You know, I talk about the Economist says, you know, consumer trust is the basis of all brand values, and therefore brands have an immense incentive to retain it. You know, Jack Ma, the infamous or famous, you know, sort of a business head, the sort of the leader of Alibaba, says, you know, once you have trust, the rest is easy. So, you know, they keep coming back to this central point about credibility is based on behavior. You know, the issue around, you know, trust in brands, the issues around brands telling the truth about, you know, brands doing things the right way. You know, I talk a lot about brands being authentic, being transparent. I mean, one of the key issues of our time, I think, you know, everyone would hopefully agree with, is that of privacy. You know, I mean, this year we've seen, you know, huge issues about sort of, you know, privacy being exposed. Only last week, you know, we heard about the latest disaster at Facebook, you know, 90 million people affected by the latest data breach. So, you know, I think in the past, you know, people just looked at that and thought, well, yeah, we know it's bad. We don't really like the idea of these companies having all this data on us, but, you know, what can we do? Now that people are seeing how it's not just a case of, you know, agencies having all this stuff on us that's been basically all this data that's been collated without our knowledge and sold to them so they can target us with, you know, more and more advertising, which may be annoying, but that's generally been about it from most people's point of view. When people are now seeing that it could well be that we have someone in the White House that really shouldn't be there, based on, you know, the impact of hyper-targeting advertising, which has undermined democracy, or perhaps the Brexit vote wouldn't have gone the way it had gone if we hadn't had, again, a sort of a usage of our data that was done in a dubious fashion, then I think people are and have, you know, really are in a situation whereby they're demanding action to be taken. And the other angle on that, obviously, is that now, I mean, I was over in Copenhagen last week at a massive sort of tech summit. There was a lot of talk there, as there are all tech summits at the moment, about more and more sort of startups are coming to market now on the basis of, you know, of monetizing our data, because it is our data. You know, my data belongs to me as much as my clothes or watch or car does, as your data does to you. And if we're now seeing more and more brands saying, okay, can we hire or can we rent your data from you, essentially pay you for it and then rent it to companies to use to target you, as soon as people I think are realizing their data is both theirs and has a monetary value which is theirs, then they're getting, you know, then their attention is sort of is peaked, should we say. So I think increasingly we're going to see privacy becoming a monetized issue, whereby people are realizing that our data is literally ours. And also finally, on a data sort of privacy side of things, or on a political privacy side of things, there are going to be far, far stricter rules coming in around the world from the point of view of how and when political parties and politicians are allowed to target us on a sort of on a micro-targeting level.
And, you know, just to follow up from that, you know, I think the one overwhelming point when it comes to data and privacy and, you know, misinformation is that nobody really wants their data to be used for something they don't understand, they don't know about, or they're not consenting to. And I think, at least in my experience, that has been the one universal point that regardless where you're coming from, what, you know, political, cultural stance you have, whatever it may be, that's the one point everyone agrees on. You know, this should not be happening. Now, just to follow up, my question, I guess, would be, do you think that there could be in, I guess, sometimes sort of diminishing returns where, you know, big social networks end up, well, failing or losing out? And that has happened in the past. An idea of too big to fail, I really think, doesn't live up to its name, because big, you know, IT and social network companies have existed before and they have been, you know, kicked to the curb for new ones. Do you think that that can happen, or are we kind of stuck with what we have?
I think we're stuck with what we have for the foreseeable future, purely because the power of the sort of, you know, tech titans is so immense that, you know, just, you know, one of the things we're seeing, which is of, you know, extraordinary importance, is that they're effectively, and they've been doing this for years, and they show no signs of slowing down. They basically are buying up every single new interesting player that comes to market. You know, if you talk to the tech startup people, and I was in Copenhagen last week, you know, massive tech summit, you know, 6,000 people. I was giving a talk there again about the book. Was, you know, people are, you know, creating, you know, new tech brands with the prime intention of selling as fast as they can to one of the giant, you know, sort of a behemoths of Silicon Valley. And nothing wrong with creating a brand you want to sell, but, you know, the point is that in order now to be a competitor to those giant brands, I think, quite frankly, nobody can see where that's going to come from, because they are so vast, and because they've bought up everything around them, in order to take them on, you're going to have to scale so quickly and, you know, and just get massive so quickly. Quite frankly, you know, how can it be done? You know, there's a lot of talk about, really, in terms of the mega brands of Silicon Valley, perhaps we've seen, you know, all the innovation, and this is a famous last words, perhaps we've seen all the innovation we're really going to see there in terms of mega new brands, you know, because the ones that are there, whoever comes up next week with an amazing new idea will just buy it, and it will be absorbed into the ecosystem of the current top few. So, you know, is someone genuinely going to be challenging Amazon, you know, in the next few years? You know, can't see it.
I mean, just before we move on, simply because this is such a fascinating, at least conversation for me, such a fascinating topic, do you think that, you know, these big tech companies and, you know, these big brands out there living in this sort of, you know, post-truth analysis and misinformation, should they be regulated? Is that possible? Can we do it? Is there anyone that can do it?
I think there is, and obviously there's just endless debate about this and what we are evidently seeing. I mean, it's interesting how the most powerful activity that's come out so far, really, obviously, has been, you know, or the most powerful sort of policy, should we say, has been GDPR, you know, which is obviously done on a pan-EU level. And that's the one thing that's really made them sit up and take notice and do something about it. You know, in terms of national laws around privacy, you know, Germany famously has always had very strict laws around privacy, you know, obviously linking back to the Second World War. And so, you know, there's no secret why it is that, you know, Facebook have got 30,000 people plus working in Germany, you know, working on privacy. It's because they have to. They don't have that many people working in, you know, Holland or England. And there's a reason for that. So, first of all, yes, national or pan-national activity is, I think, the only way that's going to really regulate these people. A lot of talk about should things be done on a UN level, you know, and in terms of privacy, you know, Wired magazine say that the battle over data privacy is the fight of our time. You know, we're looking at these corporations being involved, really, in surveillance capitalism. So should things be done on a UN sort of level to overarch things on a pan national basis? We talk a lot about technology now that, you know, the home, we're told, increasingly is the new battleground for brands. So on one side. You can say privacy being taken away works really well when it's, you know, and the classic example people always use is if it's an elderly person who is able to still retain their independence by living at home, but with some sort of technology around them, you know, whatever, so an Amazon type robot that observes them and alerts someone if they fall over or haven't taken their medicine or whatever, then you could argue that that is a positive element of, you know, privacy being taken away because, you know, by the act of doing that, it has benefited that elderly person, etc. On the other side, you know, people say that Orwell would be spinning in his grave if he'd seen us, you know, inviting these things into our homes so that they can observe us, you know, record us, film us, you know, and send back those recordings to a central database, you know, when we're being followed around the home by, you know, home droids, you know. So, you know, when Alexa and Cortana are talking with each other and whereby, you know, we have automated fridges, all the rest of it, you know, sort of, you know, reordering stuff for us in an automated home, then, you know, on one side, yeah, there are benefits, but there are also huge downsides.
Great. Well, fascinating insight there. And to close off, Sean, I want to ask you the question I ask all the guests here on the podcast, and that, what are you currently reading, or do you perhaps have any recommendations for our listeners?
Certainly. I mean, to me, book of the year has been the book by Hans Rosling, Factfulness, which has perhaps not the most immediately sort of enticing title, but it's absolutely brilliant. I think Hans Rosling, who sadly died, was an astonishingly important, and the work that he and indeed his family did done it, and his associates, which continues to be done, it was, you know, really, really super powerful. So I think that to me is the book of the year.
Great, fascinating. And of course, for our listeners, there will be a link in the description so you can go and you can check out that book yourselves. But with that, Sean, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us today on the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you.
Oh, thank you.
And of course, for those listening, if you enjoyed our conversation today, please reach out to us on social media at Lid Radio. We would love to know what you think about today's podcast. And of course, there will be links in the description below so you can find everything about the post-truth business. And of course, Sean and what he is up to. I would like to thank you very much for joining us. It is a great pleasure to have our audience on this great adventure with us. And as always, we look forward to seeing you on next week's podcast. Yes.